Okay, this is Wednesday, and then we have 3 full days, and then the retreat ends on Sunday. And so it's important to recognize to integrate this practice, to recognize that this is a kind of ideal situation here, and it's important to reflect on the conditions of the time and the place, because many times when we don't do that, then we go from, say, a retreat situation to return home or to the office, and that then we connect our experience of maybe tranquility or meditation with an environment, special place. So that oftentimes feels like that when you're at home or in the office or something, you can't be mindful. So this is where, this recognizing that the situation here is very conducive towards calm and tranquility. So because of the the agreed sila or morality that we have, the fact that it is a place that's particularly set up for meditation retreats, and so it's in a beautiful area, in as far as nature, something nature is always quite tranquilizing to us. I found living in nature, living in forests, and places where humanity has not had too much of a disastrous influence, the mind easily calms, because nature itself tends to have that calming effect on our mind. What human beings make usually tends to stimulate or irritate the mind. So, I mean, I remember one time in Thailand, living in the forest monasteries and getting a level of calm and tranquility and peace from living in the forest, then having to go to Bangkok. And so the Bangkok, of course, is a busy city, and everything there is so artificial now. There's hardly, anything natural left, big cement motorways and whatnot. And so, but this was long before all that happened. But the sense of this city, which is filled with people wearing fashions, everything that your eye contact tends to be highly influenced by the minds of other human beings. And so it stirs up, gives a lot of agitation, or it can excite, it can attract, it can stir up, it can irritate, aggravate our experience. Ajahn Chah used to, talk about living in the forest, because like trees and that which is produced by nature is what it is. It's not something that human beings make or create, or it's not ours. It is what it is. So when we begin to look at nature, then it doesn't tend to stimulate the mind in the same way that man-made things tend to do. Now this is just how I experience it, and others, you have to find this out for yourself. Living I've lived in various remote areas in Thailand. Used to like to go wandering, and lived in very poor areas and very rich areas. But generally, I found living in the forest monastery is quite a pleasant experience in terms of meditation because of the effect that nature has on consciousness. Then when I moved to England, of course, in 1977, I had to live in London for 2 years. So that was having this was a quite a shock, actually, having to live in such a huge city. But actually, London itself is quite a silent place if you compare it with Bangkok. And also the fact that it's a northern city, it's quite far north, so that there is a natural kind of stillness that's there. And when you're living in tropics and hot climates, then there's a lot of noise, even in the forest. A lot of insect noises and that is, it's just so like an incubator that just breeds endless insects and things like this. So there's a lot more noisy, naturally. But as you go further north, I've always have this strong wish to go up into the northern part of Norway and Sweden, or up toward the Arctic Circle, now, just because of the stillness and the silence of it. And it's interesting, when I'd had about 11 years as a monk by the time I went to England, and living in London, I started having these kind of nimittas or signs of just vast sky and snow and even cold and empty spaces and a sense of peacefulness where before if I thought of living up in the North Pole, you know, and these kind of visions would come and where I was out alone, out in the cold, alone in a kind of twilight world, it was neither day nor night, and there were wolves howling nearby, and winds blowing, wolves howling, and I was naked and alone out in the snow. Now this could be a nightmare, I'm sure, but actually it was peaceful. This kind of vision was not frightening to me. It was peaceful. Then when we acquired the Amaravati Monastery, the thing that's in Knightchitters in the West Sussex is a very foresty place. It says a lot of big forest, and so you live, your impression of Chitters is forest. It's the main impression. This is according to my perception. And the perception of Amaravati is sky. So living in Amaravati, it's on top of a hill, and it's like a big dome above you. It's the thing that most impressed me when I first saw it is sky, which is vast and empty. And so these are just, when you look at the sky, when you use sky as an object for meditation, it has this incredible spacious emptiness. So whether it's looking at a jungle or trees or water, a lake or an ocean or sky, this is nature. And then the of course, what we produce in around it, you know, is what we create. I create, whether I like or don't like, or if, you know, one way of looking at a forest is looking at it like you're wanting to improve it all the time. So some people, you know, I know in England, look at the Chitters Forest, and immediately it stimulates their interest in conservation and in growing trees and in doing all kinds of things. But I'm not that kind of a person. So I just see the forest, I see the trees, and my relationship to them doesn't I don't create a much kind of, I don't proliferate around that. Or the sky. I remember in the first few years of being a monk in Thailand, feeling this, looking up at the sky at night and feeling a sense of fear and frustration, you know, because it seemed so mysterious and vast, and my mind was so, seemed so intimidated by this vast dark mystery and all these stars, and so I didn't want to look at it anymore. So I had to keep my attention on more obvious things like the ground or the trees. In Thailand, in those days, the forest monasteries didn't have electricity, so we always had to carry a flashlight or something with us. And if you didn't watch where you're going, you're apt to step on insects or snakes or things like this. So in some ways, that was kind of a relief to be careful around where you're walking, because the sky was just too much for me to take, actually. So they have all these different kinds of remember, there's an ant they call Molen that comes out at night, and it's if it bites you, you really feel it. It's very, very painful. And you could hear some monk coming at night, was stepped into the midst of these Motlen, and then they do this, you'd hear this stomping. We called it the Motlen stomp. Because your only reaction is to get these things off you, because it's very painful. So in the beginning, maybe that was very good. It was like you're living in forests, in jungly areas, and places like that demanded a certain attention to the details of the life that of the creatures that you shared this forest with. And then as my meditation began to take effect, and more that I was attracted to the sky. And then by the time we moved to Amravati in about 1984, this was very much a kind of like a sign for me of this emptiness or spaciousness. An infinity, isn't it? It's space has this sense of having no boundary. You know, you look at the space in this room, you think a big space, but actually the room is in the space, isn't it? Because this building is in space, you know, and this room manages to put walls up so that our vision can't go beyond them. But it definitely, you know, that outside, that the space continues on up to where you have no knowledge of any boundary where it ceases or stops. So, dealing with the unconditioned or the immeasurable, what we can't produce in terms of form or confine in boundaries such as conditioned phenomena tends to be, then at this sense of unlimited or immeasurable or boundless or unconditioned. And of course space also the reflection on a visual experience where we don't tend to notice it till it's pointed out, even though it's right in front of us. The space is right here and we're all in this space, but say the worldly mind doesn't even notice the space. Usually it knows this person, that person, the bell, the shrine, the walls. And they say, what about the space? And you go, oh yeah. And in order to notice the space, you withdraw your interest in the things, in the men, the women, the bell, the shrine, the walls, the ceiling, and so forth. It's not that you have to get rid of them. You know, it's not a matter of asking you all to get up and go. But in terms of attention towards space rather than towards the object. or the things in the space. When you're contemplating spaciousness with as a visual experience, then your mind absorbs or tends to really concentrate on this vast spaciousness, spaciness, you have a sense of the infinite or the unlimited. No boundary. So that also, say in terms of the sound of silence, has this unlimited, it's a natural thing, isn't it? The sound of silence is it's like the sky, or it's just natural, it's not created, it's not produced by human beings. And yet you can, you know, it's the background for everything, for all sound or for all things really. So you're dealing with, you're beginning to awaken to this immeasurable, the unconditioned, that which is not bound by earth, fire, water, and air. So it's a reality that we awaken to. We begin to notice. It's not that it's something you acquire. It's an awakening. To realize this is through awakened awareness. So it's not like an attainment. It's what they call a realization. But in the Third Noble Truth, this, what they call the Nirodha, or the cessation, that dukkha ceases. As there is an origin to dukkha, there is a beginning, a birth, an origin of dukkha, there is the cessation of it. So cessation is not, is to be realized, the realization. So this English word, realization, is having awakened to reality, to the way it is. Like the space that we see in this room is, as we awaken, there is space. And even though it's been here all the time, we may not have really consciously noticed it as anything. It's just taken for granted. And of course, we when it's pointed out, then we notice it. We might notice it in just, you know, a kind of, you know, casually, oh yes. But to really awaken to the space, isn't it? It's not just the, you know, just an idea anymore, a concept, but we're awakening to the reality of space, or to the infinite, or the unconditioned. So it's realized. It's always been here and now. It's never been separate, never been anything that is not here at this moment in any at any part of our lives whatsoever. It's always here, always now, but unnoticed, through our lack of attention and through our tendency to attach to condition and just go from one condition to another. Notice how thought works when you start thinking just one thought connects to another. You know, so we used to play these games where you start bringing up one subject, you go around in a circle, and by the time it gets around to the original person, the subject is totally disconnected from what it originally was, because the mind just proliferates, you know. So the thinking mind tends to go by association. So one thought, then you associate it with something, and you proliferate, and it just wanders around like that. So, and you don't notice the spaces between the thoughts. So, if you're just caught in thinking, then you one thought goes on to the next, and it just endless kind of chain takes place, and you don't notice the space, or when the thought ceases, because even if you're not thinking all the time, you don't really notice that. You're so, your whole awareness is through thinking. Your whole sense of reality is through thinking, through concept. So then awakening allows us to see the gaps between thoughts, or the spaces, or space, or to realize the absence of thought, or the cessation of a condition. So like anger arises, and if we are mindful of anger as that which has arisen, we can sustain our attention on this feeling of anger till it ceases, and then we know non-anger, conscious, and inform ourselves through consciousness that non-anger, adosa, is like this, where we tend to not notice if we're usually we feel angry, and then we try to get rid of it, or we act, we speak on it, or we suppress it, but then we don't notice, we're not conscious of its absence, but we're certainly aware when it's present. So the mindfulness tends to be sporadic, it's a kind of this and then that and then this and then that. Where when we talk about connected mindfulness, then this is where we sustain this awareness, so that it's a flow rather than just this and that, this fragments and bits and pieces. So there's this awareness that mindfulness that is natural to us when we recognize it, realize it, in which we can see the arising and cessation of emotions, of thoughts, feelings. We know wisdom allows us to discern what the presence of a condition is and what its absence is like. What grasping is like and non-grasping, what self and non-self is. There's this mindfulness and panya, sati and panya, wisdom, is informing. We're learning, we're seeing that we know the difference. Greed and non-greed, desire and non-desire. So panya always has this discerning, this sense of discernment. But panya in this sense is not a divisive thing. It's not judging, but it knows the difference in this simple way. And just this, the conditioned and the unconditioned. Because the mindfulness then has a continuity. It's not just aware of this and then we're not. And we get lost, and then we might be aware maybe of, of kind of peak moments or extremities, but much of our life is not that extreme. And peak moments are not all that common. So we tend to get very dull and heedless in much of our life, where there's nothing really stimulating our attention, so we kind of get lost in our emotional state, fears and desires and negativity and self-pity and blame, or maybe one of the stimulating emotions I used to like when I was a university student was righteous indignation. I really liked to feel that. When you're a university student, you can get really excited and full of energy by being indignant about the state of affairs, about the way the government is, about the president, about the local politician, about the middle class white society, about the unfairness of the faults and the things that are wrong with this country. It's hypocrisy. Suddenly you've got to stop this hypocrisy. We've got so then you get very, you know, you feel really alive, and then you can point, you know, you can. I used to go on protest marches in those days, Berkeley in the early 60s. You could get yourself kind of really wound up in this state of righteous indignation that made you feel alive. And yet, to sustain that, you know, to keep myself in such a state was impossible. So you know, you had to always find something to feel indignant about. And there's plenty, you know. I was at a loss for finding objects to feel, for things to feel indignant about. But also, you know, it's tiring. And after a while, you can't get the same kick out of it that you used to, you know, when you're young and full of your kind of youthful arrogance. In monastic life, sometimes we, you know, to feel alive, since we're celibate, kind of sexual desire is not, we can't act on it. So things that are allowed is, you know, it's not breaking the vineyard, is righteous indignation and anger and things like this. So sometimes, you know, I've seen monks just, you know, always being angry with somebody because it made them feel alive, you know. And when they weren't angry, they'd just be asleep. So you could tell in evening meditation with one monk, when he was angry, he was sitting up straight. And when he wasn't angry, he was falling asleep. Because anger is a stimulating emotion. It makes you feel alive, you know. I'm really alive. But anger isn't quite as, it isn't so seemingly right as righteous indignation is right, you know. So you have a sense of I'm right. And that's a good feeling, to know you're right and somebody else is wrong. And so that, and it seems worthy, and you can oftentimes get others to go along with you. You can stir them up, and you can form a little, you have a protest march together, and you can all affirm your cause and feel all very committed to this cause and this sense of being right. But then being right, you know, is, you know, when you see this, being right also is suffering. So being attached to being right is a lot of suffering. And so this we begin to see, that just, you know, if I'm convinced I'm right and I'm very attached to being right, then I can become very insensitive. So, say I'm right and you're wrong, and so I know I'm right and I know definitely that you're wrong, but I'm attached to my view, but I'm not, then I lose. I can no longer really hear or listen or pick up on anything you're saying because I'm attached to the fact that I'm right, you know. So that's why it makes you very insensitive. Righteous people, they become totally insensitive to. So they can become very heavy, very clumsy, very cruel in a way. That I can be very cruel to somebody through the sense of my own righteousness. So knowing that, one time I remember Lajan Cha, he pointed this out about, went to, in Wat Pa Phong, we were trained very strict with the Vinaya, so we had this very high standard of discipline. And so as I had more time, about my third year, I went to the south, to Suan Mo. And I remember meeting Ajahn Buddhadasa, and he asked me what it was. They didn't really know very much about Wat Bapong in those days. So he said, "Well, we keep, our practice is doing puto," and he looked, "You're just doing puto," and then he said, "We keep very strict vinaya." So Ajahn Buddhadasa said, "Well," he said, "the real vinaya is mindfulness. If you're mindful, then that's the perfect vinaya." And implying that the vinaya was all you had to do was be mindful, and this other stuff wasn't all that. That's how I heard it anyway. So when I went back to Bapong, I told Ajahn Chah, I said, "Buddhadasa said." And so Lungpa Cha smiled. He says, "True but not right. Right but not true." And so that's an interesting reply. and so I, because it was so enigmatic, his reply, and I didn't quite get it at first, like it interested me. It was a reflection. What does he mean by that? Right but not true, true but not right. So I kept exploring that, and I could begin to see, how you can be right, in one way. But if you're not sensitive, if you're attached to being right, then you miss out that it's not really true. It's a kind of false rightness. And you lose the sensitivity because it tends to be a very arrogant position. And when, of course, arrogance and attachment to ideas blind us. So we can be right but not true, or true but not right. So like just being mindful is true. That's all there is, pure mindfulness. But to cling to that idea is not particularly right, because then we think you don't need vinaya, and just be mindful. True. But in terms of daily life, I find vinaya a big help, because if I were an arahant, then of course there'd be perfect mindfulness. But because there are moments where there's no mindfulness in that, then it helps to have these conventions that help to remind you to be mindful. They're not in themselves anything other than support for mindfulness. But if I just hold to the view, you have to have the vinaya, and you have to keep the vinaya perfectly, and become a vinaya fanatic, the same thing applies, doesn't it? You can be so attached to being perfect and strict and keep all the rules and never infringe on anything, try to live up to this very high standard of behavior, and not be mindful, because it can be another arrogant position. I'm my vinaya is very good, and I'm much better than those monks there because I'm so pure in my vinaya, which can be another form of attachment. So this attachment, in the second noble truth, the upadana, the ignorance that comes, and the desire that comes out of ignorance, and the attachment to desire. Like I was saying last night, it's not desire that's the problem, it's the attachment. The blind, ignorant attachment to desire. So there's these 10 fetters. Now the 10 fetters are the sanyojanas. Are the fetters that blind us to, first of all, the first three blind us to the path, to the Eightfold Path. So as long as, and the first three then are, and then as we let go of these fetters you've let go of the 10th fetter, then that's an arahant. Arahant fetters are no longer a problem. All 10 of them. Nothing. But then, say the first three fetters are the fetters that block us from realizing what they call stream entry or sotapanna. So the stream entry is insight into the path, or the Eightfold Path. And so what is it that blinds us to this path is the first sakyaditi, the commitment to our personality is our reality. Silabhata Paramasa, which is the Pali word for attachment to conventions, to rites, rituals, conventions, institutions, and the worldly conditions. Then the third is vicikicca, or doubt. So notice that these three fetters are this illusion of a self, of I am the five khandhas, I am this person. Then the Silabhata Paramasa is depending on conditions or conventions, thinking that if I keep all the rules, or the tradition itself, or the technique, the meditation technique, or the teacher, are going to purify me. And if I do all these things perfectly and obey the teacher and follow all the rules and eat the proper food and you can take ritual baths and perform all the ceremonies, rites, rituals, conventions, do them all, then hoping, this is some kind of superstition, isn't it, where by doing all the right things that you'll be rewarded with enlightenment. So it's attachment to the convention, even the conventions of our own tradition. And it's not the tradition or the conventions themselves, it's this ignorance and attachment to them. Or even the personality view is all right if it's not attached to it. Like we call it the conventional reality. So when is it appropriate to be Ajahn Sumedho, and when is it inappropriate? One can use the convention of Ajahn Sumedho, but it's no longer grasped out of ignorance. Or the convention of monasticism, but it's not grasped out of ignorance anymore. Or the Vinaya discipline, but it's not grasped out of ignorance anymore. We can have ideals, and all the righteous ideals or the high-minded ideals, but not grasping them out of ignorance. So it isn't, then none of these things in themselves are the problem. It's the ignorance and the grasping that is the cause of the suffering. Then thinking itself, being attached to thought, trying to figure everything out through reason and analysis and logic and trying to understand everything through having answers to every question and solving every problem, leads only to vicikicca or doubt. Because no matter how clever you might be and how intelligent your mind is, it's still you don't really know. You have to think you know or believe you know, but you don't really know. So doubt is easily takes over the mind. So if you just approach Buddhism as an academic, just figure it out intellectually, It is intellectually, it's a very, you know, it's a kind of pleasure. I find it appeals to me very much intellectually, but it's not liberating on that level. You know, just being attached to Buddhist ideas and Buddhist principles and Buddhist traditions and so forth, it still doesn't get to the, you know, the cause of suffering till we are mindful and where we can, like, then we can use the conventions without being attached to them. So then, in situations, like when, say, when life gets really difficult, you know, like there's some people that were brought up as Christians, when life gets really down, you know, then we pray to God. Because when you're a child, isn't it, I remember I used to pray to God a lot when life got unbearable for me. So then, because you don't know who else to pray to, and you have this idea God might come and help you out a bit if you beg him to. And sometimes he does. Sometimes he doesn't. But then in awakened awareness, then this is you know, where then the refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha isn't just an intellectual thing, isn't just a silabhata paramasa grasping of, I believe in Buddha Dhamma Sangha is my refuge on a level of just grasping the idea. It's not silabhata paramasa, but through awareness, then it's the Eightfold Path that we're using. So, in the experience of life, where the worldly conditions are on the downhill slide, everything's going wrong, the Eightfold Path still there. You know, it's not. You know, success or failure are no longer the ideas that you identify with. So you can learn from success and from failure, from happiness and suffering, from praise and blame, from wealth and poverty, from the best and the worst. So Lung Po Cha used to say, you know, consider, these are called the eight worldly dhammas. He said, see them as equals. So don't say it. Success, failure, is to start with having high status or having no status, being a kind of low or nobody or being somebody. You know, we all have this idea of wanting to be, you know, somebody important, be respected, be up there in the realms where people look to us and say, you know, respect our position. And we fear of just being a nobody, a kind of, you know, a tramp or somebody that nobody respects. Isn't it? That's the big dread of our lives, is if I can just be somebody important and be respected. But the fear also goes along with that. Maybe I'll end up being, you know, nobody, with nobody respecting me, then good fortune and bad fortune, or success and failure. That is, having, we all want to be successes, and we dread failure. Failure is, you know, just despicable, isn't it? Somebody who's a failure. But you say successful person, we go, oh, really? I'm not. Somebody say Ajahn Sumedho is very successful, and others say Ajahn Sumedho is a failure. So then I can, you know, it's the, you know, which is on the ego likes the success side, and but it doesn't like the failure. But the mindfulness includes both, isn't it? It's not, you know, failure is fine, success is fine. Because you learn, you know, you're not interested in identity and attaching to these, but in in being aware, in being awake. Then praise and blame. We like to be praised. You know, as my ego likes to be praised. I like to be told how wonderful I am and that kind of thing. And then being blamed or criticized, that's not very nice. Don't like that. But in terms of mindfulness, isn't it, this praise and blame of equal value, happiness and suffering. So happiness is what we spend so much of our time trying to have, and suffering is what we're trying to get away from, or fear or dread. Also, in the world, you notice when you have success, you also fear failure. You can't be successful without dreading the possibility of failure. They go together, you know. So, you know, like anyone who's had worldly success also has dread of failing. Or if your I state is the fear of losing it, or of being praised and admired, or being blamed and criticized. The more you get praised and held up, there's also incredible fear goes along with that of when it changes, when it goes the other way. So this is, you notice if you get one, you really get the other. Talking to people who have been quite successful, you know, they tell me, one to admit it, that success is pretty frightening because, you know, you reach the peak, you're at the top, but you know you can't go higher than that. So which way do you go? And so this is a reflection on, say, the eight worldly dhammas. But it's now through realizing this rather than identifying the reality. Is knowing that these are conditions, that they're not self, that in terms of developing the path, the Eightfold Path, that you learn from both. You're liberated through understanding both the positive and the negative. So in terms of one's life on the worldly level, it's not the important issue anymore. It's in fact, the monastic form, monastic life as established in our tradition, Theravada tradition, or established by the Buddha 2,544 years ago, was based on alms mendicancy. So it's like, you know, this is, taking a way of which in American ideals seems like can even be considered disgraceful. You're making yourself dependent on others. You know, where, you know, an American was brought up to think that that's disgraceful, that you should be independent. Don't owe anybody anything. And you know, self-reliance. And you just, you know, you don't owe anybody anything and you're completely independent. And then you're a success, is how I was born. Then becoming a Buddhist monk, then I realized, I'm a beggar now. I'm totally dependent on others for basic necessities, for food and shelter and all the rest. So then I thought, why did the Buddha establish his order on alms mendicancy? And Ajahn Chah had a very good answer for that, because he understood that basically human beings, our nature is very loving and generous, and that the monastic order was established in order to allow these qualities to manifest. So, you know, I just noticed that like he Ajahn Chah had tremendous faith that when I went to England, that I could live as an alms mendicant in a European country, a non-Buddhist country. And I thought, I don't know about that. I thought, it wasn't anything against England. I thought it would be impossible in the United States. Never lived in England, so I didn't know, but I assumed that it wouldn't be easy like it was in Thailand. But Lung Pa Cha said, when I questioned it, he let me know, wherever there are good people, then you can live as an alms mendicant, as a Buddhist monk. He said, in England, are there kind and generous people? I said, well, I assume there are. He said, you can go there. So it wasn't like they even had to be Buddhist. It's not that we're dependent on Buddhists, and you have to have Buddhists. But it's a kind of faith in our humanity in general. That has nothing to do with our culture or even our religion. But through, making occasion for generosity and kindness, then people will, there are people that will find great joy and happiness in providing the basic necessities. So I found that very true in the UK, for example. Lived there 24 years. Never lived so well in my life. There's never been a problem, actually. The problem is in abundance sometimes. Not the lack of food, but too much of it. So the problem is about gaining weight, not about starving to death. In affluent countries, it gives you a lot of faith in our humanity that we share. That the Buddha did understand that the monastic convention actually was established in a way that when you realize it's one of the oldest still existing conventional forms, isn't it? The Buddhist bhikkhu. The bhikkhu is one of the, still exists at this time, relatively unchanged from what it was established, from when it was established in India 2,500 years ago. And it was based on the faith in the goodness of humanity. So it wasn't based on establishing a trust fund to see that bhikkhus throughout the ages would have lots of, support through having a trust fund in a bank, but on the unknown factors of the goodness, basic goodness of humanity. So I think at this time also, this is very important to reflect on, that, because we do see oftentimes the news that we generally get about humanity is very negative, most of it, about how selfish and, we're called consumers in this country, aren't we? We're just big mouths that want to eat everything and buy everything, and we're just greedy, selfish polluters of the planet, and on like this. So we can see, we can look at humanity through its meanness and through its nastiness, or, as the Buddha did, we've seen humanity through its goodness and providing conventions and tradition that is allowing that goodness to manifest, the generosity, the kindness, the goodness. And this has been my experience as a Buddhist monk, very much as it's been both in Thailand and in England, an experience of incredible generosity and kindness, and real respect for someone who's living the holy life, and encouragement and support in every way. So it's just a very, when I think of my life as a monk, I think feel very honored that I could live like this, someone like myself had such an opportunity and had the ability to live in this form for so long, because it is supportive and helpful if used in the right way. Of course, monastic tradition can be used in the wrong way. That's how you want to use it. So you meet monks who are arrogant, power hungry, miserly, and so forth. And then it's easy to put down Buddhism. They look at that monk, he's no good. He's got 10 Mercedes Benz. And he watches television all the time, he doesn't meditate. And so then they say Buddhism is degenerated. And in Thailand, people keep saying, "Oh, Buddhism is degenerating. It's really falling apart." I said, "No, it's not. I think maybe Thais are degenerating, but Buddhism not." So you get it in the right perspective. It's not. It may be certain monks are degenerating, but the Sangha is not. Look at it like this, and the fact that the Buddha's teaching has been, have been maintained in their purity up to this present time. Like what we're doing now is a reflection, is using this the pure teaching of the Buddha. It's not been corrupted or changed in any way. Where on other levels, maybe the corruption takes place with individuals identified as monks or sangha or whatnot, but when we look at it in terms of what we have, then we realize that it's still pristine and very skillful tool for developing awareness and to realize enlightenment. So offer this as a reflection for this evening.
Namaya.